As we move into the next part of our world religion series, I had to have a little bit of a chuckle when I was doing some research. So we're looking at Judaism today. And I'd actually never come across this. This was new to me. But did you know that many people who own homes in Jerusalem or within Israel have what they call the Messiah clause in their contracts? You see, there are a lot of Jewish people that actually live around the world. They don't live in Jerusalem or within Israel itself, but they own homes in Jerusalem or Israel. And Judaism actively believes that the Messiah is still to come. So one of the key differences, of course, but you know, it is the key difference between Judaism and Christianity, is Christianity believes the Messiah has already come and is going to return, whereas Judaism believes that the Messiah has not yet come. But so worried or potentially afraid are people that they might miss out on the Messiah coming, they need to make sure that they can still have access to their homes if the Messiah was to return. And this is the reason why. So the clause that they actually put into their contracts is this. Upon the coming of the Messiah, tenants agree to vacate the apartment within 15 days. Now, this particular contract was for a couple who own a home in Israel but live in the USA. And the reason why this is important is that if you actually follow the Judaistic understanding and beliefs around the Messiah, remember that, and we'll get to this a bit later, they don't only follow what we call the Old Testament, they also have what's called the Talmud, and I'll explain that a bit more later. But across those two, they've got lots of teachings around what's going to look like when the Messiah comes. So one of the things that's prophesied amongst those scriptures is that when the Messiah comes, there will be no more war, murder, or theft in Jerusalem. That the temple that was there back in years gone past will be rebuilt, and all Jews will return to the land of Israel to live out a life of paradise. And so if you own a home in Israel, in fact, this is why many people who are Jewish around the world will make sure that they own property in Israel, because they want to make sure they've got a house to come back to when the Messiah comes, so that they can come and live in this place of paradise. Now, the little fly in the ointment that I didn't quite find an answer to is, what about the people who passed away owning homes, and that when they're going to be, you know, when they're going to come back to life, if they're resurrected, depends on what part of Judaism is to whether or not that's part of your faith, who's going to own the home? Who's actually going to get to live in that house, and how does that live out? But I found this really fascinating, because one thing it definitely shows is just how much they believe in the Messiah coming, that they would go to the point where they actually make sure that they have a property in Jerusalem or in Israel itself that they can come and be a part of. So that's the Messiah clause. And that's a bit of an introduction today as we move on to looking at Judaism. We're doing a series over the next few weeks looking at world religions. If you know people who are in our culture, if you know people on your street, if you know people in your workplace, and you know they're not Christian, that means they have another worldview. They have another way of looking at the world, another perspective. It might be another faith or another understanding. And a really helpful thing for us as Christians is to have at least a cursory understanding of what those faiths are, at least some level of understanding, so that if we're having conversations with them, we don't seem completely naive to what they believe. Now, the reality is I'm not going into the dark, dark, deep depths of these faiths. I'm just really sort of looking at what are some of the key aspects that help you, so that when you might be talking with someone from this faith, you can at least hold a conversation. But also, more importantly, trying to express, how do you bring Christianity into that place? How can you actually look at comparing and contrasting what that looks like? Today, I was kind of torn in two directions. And I'll be honest, when you're writing a sermon, when you're torn in two directions, you're taught to go one way. I haven't actually done that today. I've decided to leave two aspects. Because on the one hand, I want to talk a bit about the faith today and Judaism's faith today. But because of the Christian heritage within Judaism and the fact that we've been born out of that, I also want to look a little bit about the history of it and how we can sort of look at how that can help enrich our own faith and our own understanding of Christianity. So the main question that I'm looking at today is, what's a Christian to do with Judaism? So just to get started, and most of the introductory stuff you'll actually probably already know, though I still want to give a little bit more of a rounding to what it actually means. So Judaism is called an Abrahamic faith. That just means it's one of the major faiths that ties itself back to Abraham. So Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, they're the major faiths that would all say that Abraham was a significant part of their faith and their journey. There are some other obscure little sects or breakaways that have kind of formed normally out of one of these things that would also call themselves Abrahamic faiths. But on the whole, it's those three faiths. It's also monotheistic. So we talked about this last week. Monotheistic means it believes in one God. So Judaism believes there is only one God, not multiple gods, not lots of gods. They don't believe in the Trinity, which we will come to, but they do believe that there's one God. One of the key distinctions, though, between Judaism and Christianity, and even Islam, is it's also an ethnic religion. That means there's a strong part of Judaism which is tied to your family heritage. That in many ways, actually being born into a Jewish family is as significant, if not more significant, than becoming a Jew. And so we'll talk to that a little bit. There's actually about 14 million Jewish people, or people who would consider themselves Jews, around the world. And only about 5 million of them live in the Jewish state of Israel. So about 5 million live in Israel. That means there's 9 million people with Messiah clauses, probably, around the world, ready to come back and to come into Israel if and when the Messiah returns. It's founded by Abraham. Again, not anything new to us, because we should have an understanding that that's where it came from. Around 1800 before the Common Era. So we're actually further past Jesus than what Abraham was before Jesus. We're actually further beyond that than what it actually was for when Abraham was around. And it was believed at that time that God made a covenant with Abraham. So of the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism would say that Abraham is the most important figure within the understanding, because that's who the covenant was formed with. Islam, which we'll come to in a few weeks' time, it's more about Muhammad. Obviously, Christianity is more about Christ. But for Judaism, Abraham is the big deal, and making the covenant with God was the most important part of their faith. Now, here's the interesting thing. Well, at least I found this interesting. You can convert to being Jewish, but traditionally, a person is born Jewish. Traditionally, Judaism is actually passed on by your family heritage, and actually follows the maternal line, which is really interesting, because Judaism has a lot to do about the males. And you see all the, when you look in the Bible and you read all of the chronological, you know, the different family trees and things, that's always the man. But actually within Judaism, it follows the mother, and that comes out of the Talmud. So that's one of their teachings that I'll be unpacking shortly. That's where that comes from. But it's more through the mother's line. And to convert to Judaism is not as simple as praying a prayer. To convert to Judaism, you've got to convince a rabbi, you've got to start living your life, you've got to actually prove that you're worthy of being a Jew. And so many, if not most people, don't actually bother with taking the extra step to become a practicing Jew. In some cases, they'll just start to practice Judaism without actually converting to the faith, because it is actually really hard to do. But generally speaking, Judaism is actually passed on by heritage. This is also why you don't find a lot of people trying to convert you to Judaism. You don't find people door knocking to say, hey, come and be a Jew. You'll actually really not find much evangelistic flair within Judaism in any way, shape, or form. They're really not looking to convert the world to Judaism. It's just not what they believe. It's not what they believe is important. They do have thoughts about what happens to people who aren't Jews, and that will come up as we go through, but they're just not evangelistic in the sense that you'd think of, like Christianity and like Islam and many other faiths. If you weren't born a Jew, they're really not too concerned if you become a Jew. Now, the teachings, and this is where it is a really important thing to understand the distinctions between the Christian Bible and the Jewish Bible. The Jewish have what they call the Hebrew Bible, or the Tanakh, T-A-N-A-K-H. KH. This basically has the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Christian Bible. Then they have what's called the Nevi'im, which are the prophets. And then they have the Ketuvim, which is the writings. And if you were to write this in Hebrew, that would spell out T-A-N-A-K-H, or sometimes it's just T-A-N-A-K. And that's where it gets from. So you may not know this, but the Jewish Old Testament is not in the same order as the Christian Old Testament. The books in the Jewish Bible are actually in a different order. Now, it's a shame we don't have a giant screen this week, because it would be really helpful to see that a bit better, but we have to work with what we have. So what we actually have in the Jewish Tanakh is you have the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They're in the same place as the Christian Bible. They're right there at the very beginning, and that's the basis of their written law. If you hear about the written law, that's in those five books. Then they actually have what are called the Nevi'im, the prophets. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, then the 12 minor prophets that you'll find. And that's where they sit. Then at the end, you'll have the writings, which is your Psalms, your Proverbs, Job, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther, Daniel. Interestingly, in the Jewish Bible, Ezra and Nehemiah are not two books. They're one. Ezra and Nehemiah are actually one scroll, and they're read together, and they're actually read as being a continuation of each other. Whereas in the Christian Bible, we've separated them. And then Chronicles is actually at the end of the Jewish Bible. Now, this is actually important to understand. There is a reason, obviously, why it was changed in the Christian Bible, and I won't delve into that too much today because we'll probably be here all afternoon. But it does actually change the way you read some of these things. And so when you actually go back and you look at the way it was written, when Jesus is teaching about the Old Testament, when Jesus is teaching about the Tanakh or the writings or the teachings, he actually knows the Bible in this order. And there are times that he ties things together because they actually fit that way in the way they were written in the Jewish scriptures that we miss because we've reordered the books of the Old Testament. And so again, it's not something you're going to master overnight and go, oh, this is where that's changed and why it's changed and why it's there. But even if all you come away from today is even knowing this is the case, it really can change the way that you read through some of the Old Testament. And you can buy some Christian Bibles that have reordered the books back in the order of the Jewish scriptures. And it actually can be quite interesting to read through it in the order that it originally was. If you're not sure why it was changed, again, there's a long story around it. Go and Google it. Be a bit, I'm obviously quite careful sometimes about saying go and Google things because who knows what's going to come up. Generally speaking, if you Google that, you're going to be fairly safe about it. It's just going to give you some history about what they were thinking and why they made these changes. But it does change things. And it is really helpful sometimes to get some of the context around what was going on and why things were written the way they were when you're actually reading through. But more than just that, and this is where we get some of our confusions between Christianity and Judaism, is Judaism has more than just the Old Testament. They also have what's called the Talmud. Now, the Talmud, you might have heard it sort of written about in the Bible or in the New Testament as being the oral law. So for a very long time, they had the written law, which was what's written in the Tanakh. And then there was a whole lot of other teachings that were associated that were passed on orally that weren't written down. But then over the years, they've slowly written them down. And that now sits in a book called the Talmud. It is just as important-ish. I mean, they would always say the Tanakh is the most important, but the Talmud is interpretations of the Tanakh. And so as you read the Talmud, you're learning how to interpret the Old Testament or the Tanakh of the time. The key thing to understand here for a Christian or a person who is from a Jewish perspective is Christians have never accepted the Talmud. So the teachings of the oral law, there are sects within Christianity or there are some groups within Christianity that have explored the Talmud. And it's not to say that everything in the Talmud is wrong. There's actually some really good stuff in the Talmud which helps you understand the world that Jesus entered and it helps you understand the teachings that Jesus was speaking to. But the oral law has never been part of the Christian faith. It's only the Tanakh that Christians have actually taken as being authoritative for the way that we live. And so some of the reasons why we come across differences in how a Jewish person follows the Old Testament and a Christian follows the Old Testament is because the Jewish person is using an interpretation from the Talmud, whereas a Christian is using an interpretation straight from the Tanakh that's been a different interpretation of it. Okay, I don't want to go too much further there because I'm going to lose you, but just be aware that that's why there are some significant differences. You'd say, we follow the same book, we follow the same Old Testament. How is it that they apply it one way and we apply it another? Well, because they've actually got another interpretation lens to look through. If that doesn't confuse you enough, they also have another thing called the Midrash. You may have come across the Midrash, and this is thoroughly confusing because it is both an interpretive style, so just it's a way of interpreting the Tanakh, but it is also a separate body of commentaries, a separate body of books. And so it can be both a way that you read the Old Testament, but it also is some extra books, some extra things that are seen as being authoritative and help you to read the Tanakh through a Jewish lens. And so Jewish people today, they're not trying to read it through the same lens as Christians. They're absolutely putting the Tanakh through the lens of their Talmud and the Midrash and the way that rabbis have added to that over time. And since Jesus, more things have been added in terms of understanding how you would read the Old Testament. Much as Christians today have commentaries, much as Christians today have ways of reading, we just don't say that commentaries are authoritative. Jewish people would say they're authoritative. But if you're a Christian and you're trying to talk to a Jewish person, you're adamant that your reading of the Old Testament is right, maybe take a step back and recognize that part of the reason they believe what they believe is they have another lens that they're looking through. And so it might actually be helpful to read through some of the Talmud at times to get a bit of an understanding of why they might read Old Testament passages differently and not just because of Jesus. It's another lens that they look at the Tanakh through. If you were to step back in time and look at the time when Jesus was around, who were the different kinds of people? Because we can, in some ways, say, oh, the Israelite people or the Jewish people. And we can say that they're all the same, but that's a bit like saying all Christians. And then you go, hang on a second, don't lump me in with all Christians because I know there are some Christians I don't want to be lumped in with. There were all kinds of different Jewish understandings, even at the time of Jesus. And you even see it in the New Testament when it talks about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were two distinctly different groups that had different interpretations of the Old Testament. So the Pharisees are from all economic classes. They have people in the low class, the middle class, and the high class. But they were teachers of the law. They were really, really focused on getting the law right. They were your accountants. They were the people who really, really knew like the minutiae, the very smallest detail of what the law was saying. They believed that there would be a resurrection, and they believed that it resurrected from the dead and that there is an afterlife. So they take from both the written law and the oral law that it was forecast that all people would rise eventually and that there would be life beyond the dead. Then there's another group that are called the Sadducees, and these are often paired together, which we kind of read there and go, oh yeah, Pharisees and Sadducees. This is a really odd combination. The main thing that tied the Pharisees and the Sadducees together is that they were convinced that Jesus was wrong. And that was why they were together so much. They actually have very distinctly different beliefs. The Sadducees tended to only be from the upper class. You very rarely had someone from the lower class or the middle class as a Sadducee. And that's partly because they were mostly priests of the temple. And if you got the flush gig of being a priest in the temple, you did well for yourself. You would very rarely fall down in the ranks in cultural society because it really was quite a well-paid job and something that was well to do. They do not believe, or did not believe, they're not really, they don't really exist now. They did not believe in resurrection. They did not believe in an afterlife. The Sadducees believed that you lived this life, you followed God as best you could, and then you died. And that's it. And they got that from their interpretation of the Tanakh and the Talmud. And they were convinced that the Old Testament said nothing about these things. I find it hard to believe, but it was there. And these were the priests. These were the people teaching in the synagogues, and they didn't actually believe in the resurrection or the afterlife. I find that quite fascinating. Then there's another group that you might read about called the Zealots. Now, Saul was one of these, who became Paul. He was a zealot. They were very zealous, hence the name, about following. They were more of a political movement. So the Pharisees really cared about the law, like judges care about the law. Zealots cared about the law like politicians care about the law. And I'll leave the inference there. You can probably work out what that means. But they were really political about getting it right. And then in the first century, they wanted to expel Rome from the ruling the Holy Land. And if that meant that they had to go to war to do so, then that's what they had to do. Pharisees were actually happy to kind of live and let live as long as they were allowed to follow their way of teaching. It's one of the key differences there. But there was a lot of uprisings from the Zealots who decided to take Rome and realized they had no hope in this side of the world of actually doing so. There's another group called the Essenes, which we don't know much about. There's nothing really written about them in the Bible, per se. There's not really mentioned there. But we actually, because of inference and of other things we've since found, there's strong conjecture that John the Baptist was probably fairly influenced by this group. They meticulously observed the law of Moses. They tended to separate themselves and go out and sort of be little groups of people rather than being amongst the great unwashed. And they were really, really focused on being like a remnant. They kind of saw themselves as the only group that was actually following Judaism. They were the only group that was doing it right. And the reason we know about them is if you've heard of a thing called the Dead Sea Scrolls. These were found a few years ago. It was all the rage because there's all kinds of stuff written in the Dead Sea Scrolls that back up the Bible. And there's all kinds of stuff in the Dead Sea Scrolls that challenge the Bible. And so these came from the Essenes. It was a group, an outcropping outside of Jerusalem that they'd been living, and they had all kinds of writings that were discovered. And so that's who they came from. That's how we've come to know that they existed. And then also we had a group called the Samaritans. And again, you probably would have heard of the Samaritans. The Samaritans are actually half Jewish. So they wouldn't be considered fully Jewish, and Jews did not see them as half Jewish. But the reality is they actually are. Because they were half Jewish, half Gentile. They claim to be the remnant from two of the early tribes, from Ephraim and Manasseh. And they have their own version of the Torah. So it's a slight variation on what we would say is the Torah. They've got their own interpretation of it, and it's also rewritten, and there's some fairly significant differences. Another key difference from the Samaritans was they believed that it was not where the temple was, should not have been where it was, that it actually should have been on Mount Gerizim. It's a completely different mountain in Jerusalem, but that's where they believe that you actually should worship God. And so Jews did not like the Samaritans, Samaritans did not like the Jews. In all likelihood, they're kind of offshoots from Abraham themselves. But they certainly were not seen as being Jewish, and you definitely did not want to associate with them if you were Jewish. Hence why when Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, they couldn't even bring themselves to say it was the Samaritan that did the right thing, because there's no way a Samaritan could do the right thing. There's no way that that could be the right way of going about things. But it's an interesting little thing you can go down. Looking at modern Judaism, what are some things to understand that, again, shape why people who are in this faith do things the way they do, as opposed to Christians? So the modern Judaistic faith follows a lunar calendar. So we get our dates for things like Easter based on the lunar calendar, but Christmas is always on the 25th of December. Generally speaking, Christianity follows the larger calendar, the 12-month calendar, but the Jewish faith absolutely still follows the lunar calendar. That's why things move around. Passover is celebrated at different times across the year. And their days start at sunset. So again, I remember when I first saw this, it kind of revolutionized my world. I was like, you mean the day doesn't have to start in the morning? Like that's a worldview that I thought the world always started in the day. But it's because the way that they read Genesis, it talks about there was evening and there was morning the first day. And so they actually take it as that when God created the world, he actually started with the sun being at sunset. You went into nighttime and then came into the first day. And so their interpretation of Genesis 1 is that that is actually how the day operates. I have to say that I used to be able to do this on a day off. I can't do it now that I've moved it to Tuesday. My day off, I used to run Wednesday into Thursday. And there actually is something completely different about that rhythm. There's something about living rest into work, which is really quite different than living work into rest. And there's a mind shift, there's something that switches in actually living that way. I would, if I could, change every day to actually operate in the Jewish way. That's just my own personal thing. I'm not saying that's accurate. I'm not saying that's the right way. I am definitely happy to say that it's different. And you experience the days quite differently. And that's a really important aspect for the Jewish faith. So that's why we always say the Sabbath is Saturday, which is true. So then you get confused when you see them going to the synagogue on Friday night. Because for a Jew, the Sabbath, the Saturday, actually starts on Friday night. And so that's why in many cases they'll go to synagogue on Friday, because for them it's actually Saturday, because they've started the next day moving into the rhythm. And so you don't call a Jew out for going to synagogue on a Friday for the Sabbath, because you're actually the one who's got the misinterpretation there. Passover, I alluded to that before. This shifts. It's generally around Easter, but it does actually move a little bit. And this is because there were some changes made in the 4th century by the church, where the church decided where Easter was going to fall, and they separated it from necessarily having to be associated with Passover. Prior to the 4th century, Easter always followed Passover, because that's how it happened when Jesus was here. That is actually the rhythm. It was Passover, and then it was Easter. We sometimes now have it get a bit mixed up, because the church sets when Easter is, and the Jewish faith sets when Passover is. So it moves around a little bit. Again, you may not have thought about this, because when we think about other faiths, we don't necessarily give them the same credit as what we have. There are so many denominations within Judaism. So saying the Jewish faith is a bit like saying the Christian faith. So within the Jewish faith, they've got many different viewpoints. Some of them are varied around an Orthodox faith, and so they're going to be very meticulous about the way things are viewed. The Reformed wing of the Judaism church, don't get confused. In the Christian world, Reformed is quite conservative. But in the Jewish world, Reformed is actually quite progressive. So that's the progressive arm of the church. And also there are other things around that space. Now, you can be a cultural Jew or you can be a religious Jew. So there are lots of people who follow the cultural understanding of being Jewish without following any of the religious ceremonies or any of the religious aspects. Why? Because remember, Judaism is ethnic, not just about actually observing the religious aspects. If you're born a Jew, you can culturally practice being a Jew without actually having to live out a faith in God. And so you will find some people that call themselves Jewish that never darken the doors of a synagogue because they're culturally Jewish, like we sometimes have cultural Christians who follow that. Salvation is not essential. Salvation is not essential in Judaism, because a person is not required to be Jewish to be saved. There's a writing in the Talmud, so again, not in the Tanakh, in the Talmud, so the other part of their teaching, that says, the righteous amongst the Gentiles have a place in the world to come. So because of that, this is one of the reasons why they're not as evangelistic. You don't have to be a Jew to actually be saved. What you need to do, so in case you're wanting to, you know, be saved and not have to worry about Christianity, here's a little cheat course. It's the 7 Noahide laws. They take it from Noah, so this is how Noah's gone about it. Is you should establish laws. It's okay to establish laws. Just don't curse God. Don't practice idolatry. Sorry, as Christians, you practice idolatry because you worship Jesus as a God, so you're out. Do not engage in illicit sexuality. Do not participate in bloodshed, and do not rob. Do not eat raw flesh from an animal. Cook it, you're all good. Eat raw fish, you're not saved. That's why you'll see they'll often boil, they'll make sure any meat is boiled so that it's not raw, because they want to make sure that they don't eat meat that has not actually been looked after. For modern Jews, they are still expecting a Messiah. Most aspects of the Jewish faith still expect that a Messiah is going to come, everyone is going to be raised back from the dead, and Jews will go and live a life of paradise in Israel. And exactly what happens beyond that, there's not a lot of agreement around. But again, if you've been a good Gentile and you've managed to live and follow those seven Noahide laws, there's going to be something. And the temple is going to be rebuilt. That's what they're looking forward to. And synagogue is the equivalent of church. So in many ways, they'll go along to synagogue. It's not every Sunday. It's generally Saturday. They also have midweek meetings and other times and other aspects. Across the year, there are other times that you would go. Just like in Christianity, we have our other times like life groups and other ceremonies that we might do. But it's also a significant place of study and of assembly. And it's been part of Jewish practice since at least the 3rd century. You don't see a lot of synagogue practice in the same way in Jesus' time. In Jesus' time, it tended to be that you went to the temple. Or you had different things in your homes and ways of doing it. Because the temple was destroyed when Jerusalem was taken over, they had to come up with a new way of being Jewish. And so that's where synagogue came from. So what are their views on Jesus today? At best, they see Jesus as being a teacher or a prophet. So many Jewish people will actually be happy to say Jesus was a prophet, but that's it. At best, he was a prophet. Jesus was not the Messiah, and there's a very specific reason why. He didn't restore Israel. So if you take both the Tanakh and the Talmud, it makes it really clear. The Messiah is going to restore Israel, and that's one of the key markers, and they're going to build a literal temple. And so that's what they're expecting. Because Jesus didn't, he talked about, bury me and I will be raised in 3 days. And it was talking about, that was the temple he was talking about, not a literal temple, which is what they were what Jewish people would expect. Jesus could not have been God. The Trinity is absolutely antithetical to a view of monotheism. They just will not accept the idea that Jesus and the Holy Spirit could be part of God. If you believe in the Trinity, you are practicing idolatry. Only God the Father is God. So at best, Jesus might be a prophet, but if you think he was God, you are idolatry. And so that's one of the key challenges in that faith. And some parts of Judaism accept Jesus as a Messiah, but not the Messiah. A Messiah, not the Messiah. So the key reason why I wanted to express and look at this today, and you'll see I've kind of got the two threads, is what's modern Judaism like, but also how can we understand and how can we practice our own faith, recognizing that we have significant Jewish heritage, is that I am convinced that a better understanding of Judaism can help you to lead and have a better understanding of Christianity. If you can get a feel for what was going on in the time of Jesus, a lot of things have shifted since then, and Judaism is quite different now than what it was even at the time of Jesus. But if you can get a feeling of what was going on at the time of Jesus, you will have a better understanding of how to interpret the New Testament and how to understand the Old Testament through a Christian lens. So a few passing thoughts that I'll work through quickly. If you're exploring faith through a Jewish lens, many Jews view following Jesus as meaning having to renounce being a Jew. And renouncing being a Jew is kind of like renouncing your life. Now, reality is we're asking everyone who wants to become a Christian in many ways to turn away from their previous life. But if you're ethnically a Jew, it is so much a part of your identity. It can be really hard for a Jewish person, because they will view it as they've got to stop going to synagogue, they've got to stop associating with their friends. Well, again, possibly quite true. but it's a really hard ask for someone where it's your family connections. Many Jews are more culturally Jewish than religiously Jewish, just like Christians. So if you're talking to someone, find out what they mean by when they say they're Jewish. If they're going along to synagogue and celebrating and taking part in all the religious parts, they're probably religiously Jewish. Otherwise, they're probably just saying they're related to Jews and they're culturally Jewish. That will change the way that you approach things. And Judaism is as diverse as Christianity. Ask really good questions. Try and understand their perspective and find out what it is that makes them say they're Jewish as a way of finding out ways to talk about Jesus. One thing I wanted to say, and then I've got a book recommendation, is I want to just draw on one story from Luke chapter 24, verse 25 to 27. So this is right at the end of Jesus has died on the cross. He's risen again, and he's actually now appearing to some of the followers of himself, but it doesn't look like himself. They don't realize they're talking to Jesus. But this is what it says. He, Jesus, said to them, "How foolish you are and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets," you see that order? Because the prophets were there at that part of the Bible. They weren't later on at the end like they are announced. So with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Why do I share this? Why is this important? When Jesus was wanting to explain the Messiah and the concept of the Messiah to the earliest Christians, he was able to use just the Old Testament to point to himself. Everything that is required to meet Jesus, everything that is required to understand the purpose of Jesus can be found in the Old Testament. Now, the New Testament is really helpful because we see how the new church organized themselves and how they shifted and changed and made some things happen. But you can absolutely find Jesus on every page throughout the Old Testament, if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. The final thing I want to give you is a book recommendation. And it's a book called Misreading Scripture with Western Eyes. Really fascinating book. I'm going to speak a bit more to this concept in a couple of weeks when I look at New Age spirituality. Because one thing that we miss a little bit. Now, Judaism is often called a Western religion because of where it's related to the world. But the worldview of Israel, of Jerusalem, actually more fits an Eastern mindset. And if you don't know the difference here, come back in a couple of weeks when I'm looking at New Age spirituality. It is very significant. To look at the world through an Eastern worldview is very different to a Western worldview. One of the simplest ways, and if you actually talk to someone who studies these things, they'll tell you this is too simplistic, but I'm going to say it because I find it helpful, is in a Western mindset, we look for evidence. We look for A plus B equals C. If there are two contrasting ideas, one has to be right and one has to be wrong. And that's just the way it is. Unless you live in a country that has an Eastern mindset. An Eastern mindset can see two completely contradictory things and they will agree that they're contradictory. But they will not feel the need to resolve the contradiction. They will not feel the need to say that's right and that's wrong. They will live quite comfortably in the tension of those two contradictions being the truth. And I can't even begin to understand that because I am so thoroughly immersed in a Western worldview. But it really does change. If you go through the Old Testament and you're trying to use the Old Testament through a Western lens to prove everything, it just was not written to be read that way. It's just a completely different way of understanding things. I've well and truly used my time today. I apologize. It probably is two sermons in one. But I hope that's given you a bit of an idea and understanding of both the Judaism that is birthed and leads to the Christian faith, but also how it might look different today and how you can actually use that to connect to someone of the Jewish faith. Let's just pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this time. We want to thank you for the heritage that we have. It is a rich heritage of faith over many, many generations. But we thank you for Jesus, and we thank you that we can know him and that we can experience the fullness that the Messiah brings. We pray for our Jewish cousins, if you will, that they would see the Messiah that they've been waiting for and longing for is already in our midst, and that they too might come home to know you as their Lord and Savior. We thank you in Jesus' name.